tonight on Arena. We'll be talking about two new INO operas at Kilkenny Arts Festival, and Leanne O'Donnell will be in to talk about her latest novel, Sparks of Bright Matter. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena, or you can watch live on rte.ie/arena. Actor and writer Garrett Keogh is bringing his one-man play Headcase, the love song of an A&E patient, to Bewley's Cafe Theatre. The play follows 24 hours of the central character's experience in A&E. It's a return to the Dublin stage for Garrett, who appeared in Conor McPherson's Port Authority back in 2019 and has been running the Gap Arts Festival in Wexford. Garrett is also a stalwart of the screen, with appearances in the likes of The Last Furlong, The Clinic, Raw, Jack Taylor, Veronica Guerin, Evelyn, Angela's Ashes, to name a few. He joins me in studio now. Garrett, tell us about what happens in Headcase.
Well, a man goes to the A&E, the E&R, the E.D., call it what you will, it's where you never want to be. And it's about, he's had a bang in the head, so he has to stay there. He needs to be looked at, looked after. And of course, it becomes a saga, as anyone who's been involved in that, you know, knows it. And it goes on all through the day, it goes on all through the night. At one point, he gets demoted from a little cubicle into a back room corridor where they're actually queuing, not for a trolley, they're queuing for a chair. And it's pretty bad. And you know, we're all aware of what it's like, but I'm not a statistician, and I'm not going to go into like how many are on hospital trolleys today or yesterday or that. But from an artistic point of view, it just shows like what happens to the guy, and some of the people he meets. Some are very nice, and some are a bit in need of help. There's one, for example, he meets a woman who looks very bad, like she's maybe well out of it, and for some reason, having been there most of the day, she gets up to go, and he looks at her, and she turns to him, and she says, "What are you looking at? You? What are you looking at? You see me? I'm wandering in a haze of blood for all the good it does me. I told the doctors there's a fire. I said a fire up in my brain. It's causing me such pain. I want to light a match, catch the white, the dragon snatch, step outside, use the loo. My heart, my soul is split in two. All I know, this is the glue that plasters over, gives me cover, lets me be a better lover of myself and sometimes others. So excuse me, friend, while I explain. And you, what are you looking at too? To you and her and him, I'm wandering, hollow-eyed and hilly-eyed, looking like I'm pilly-eyed, but never, ever, ever judge the book by just its cover, because if you could see the me inside, I'm shimmering and glimmering, I'm a bleeding illuminating here, I'm shooting like a brilliant silver star, see me shining from afar, inside of me I'm golden like the moon, I'll be a fighter very soon. Except, you see, I took the punches early rounds, and parts of me stayed on the ground. But by this hazel wand and cherry stick, this rustling foil, this holy oil, I'll find love lost, I'll kiss his lip. Doctor, doctor, I said, doctor, I light a fire up in my brain, incendiarise the pain. Do you like that word? Even if it is myself, I said, I'm burning with the flame. You see? Do you see? I am not incapable of lucidity. Just that every day it comes a gnats less frequently.
I didn't even need to ask you to give us a little something from the play. You perform all of the parts in it as well, and it takes place over the space of a single day, am I right?
Well, yeah, it goes day into night, you know, it gets later on, and you know, there are a variety of people. There's an old woman that he meets, a very, very old woman, and she says that it wasn't like this when she was a kid, you know. She said that if we fell at play and needed stitches, we'd walk, the gang of us, Jervis, the Richmond, the Matter, Mercer's by the Green. We walked in, children, no waiting. We were seen. None of this, like dirt thrown onto the floor. Yeah. And then she says, you know, and we've paid for this. She said, we've paid through the nose for this all our lives. And then she says, if in a corner shop you bought the like of this, you turn around, demand your money back.
Tell me a little bit about the writing process, because it's written by you. The play is self-directed, but you collaborated with people that you trusted throughout the process of it to get into the final script.
Well, these are based on, I suppose, like I had a lot of experience with a grand aunt, a grand uncle, with my mother, with myself, with others, as everyone has, going in and out of hospitals. And I would have taken Well, I would have observed, I would have taken notes, and I would have heard stories from other people. So I decided last year at the Gap Arts Festival, which we hold down where I live in North Wexford every year, we bring in professional theatre where it hasn't been seen since the fit-ups came with a tent in the 60s, and this is our 14th year. And last year we put on our own production for the first time, it was this. So I would write it, and then I would collaborate with Trevor Knight, a musician and composer that I've worked with many times before, with Marie Tierney and Conleth White on lighting and design and costume and set. And I would write and write a scene, and I'd try it out. And I'd go and visit them, but then I'd do it on WhatsApp. I'd record a section, I'd record 5 minutes, I'd look at it until I got sort of thought it was right, tweak the writing, I'd send it to them and get their reactions and suggestions and criticisms. And then I go down, Trevor now lives in North Wexford too, and I go into his studios. And when we go there, because we've worked together quite a lot over the years, it'd be like a jam rather than a rehearsal of a play. And we'd feed off each other. He'd try a sound, he has a collection of weird global instruments, and as well as a whole lot of electronic stuff. And so we try things out, and it would inspire me, and you know, he would take inspiration from it, and that's how it grew.
It's a very 21st century way of collaborating though as well, of, you know, banging things back and forth through WhatsApps.
Well, maybe it is, but we got used to a lot of that during what's that? Don't mention that word anyway.
Yeah, yeah, don't mention the word. The inspiration for Headcase, you've talked about it a little, but is it more personal experience? Is it more observation of the health system that you see today? Is it just a great big mixture of both of those things?
Well, I think it's something that needs to be said. You know, something does need to be said. I mean, it's very, very obvious. And at the same time, I'm conscious that this is Bewley's. It's lunchtime. It's Grafton Street. It's Dublin. It's crowded streets. If I was walking along the street, you wouldn't get me to go in there if I didn't think there was going to be a laugh in it, you know. So there is. So you've got to kind of do it with a pizzazz. You've got to do it with a bit of sparkle. You've got to do it like... And when you have classically trained pianist Helene Montague playing live, well, you know, that's pizzazz. So it'll be hopefully an interesting, entertaining evening. Afternoon. Well, lunchtime. That maybe will touch a chord in people, and they might just feel or think, well, I've been there. I know something about that, and you know, it's important.
Is it something that you've changed to fit the space? Because you're right, Bewley's of an afternoon. That's quite a specific experience.
Well, yeah, I don't think so. I mean, in my experience, I've performed in Bewley's a couple of times, and I've seen a couple of plays there most recently, a week or two ago, that the audience that comes are very open. And, you know, I think that we'll make them sit on the edge of their seats.
You're going to perform a little something else from the play for us as well. What have you got? And maybe just tell us a little bit about the character.
Well, this is the man himself observing like what is going on around him, but the day has dragged and dragged and dragged on, and it goes like this. It's getting on for evening now, tea time even now, but in here you'd hardly know it. Fluorescent all day lights don't show it. It's as busy still as before, as busy as it's been all day. New set of nurses, new set of doctors, another shift of porters. Change of the guard of the woolly pulley Navy Army jumper security men and women. As busy still as before, as full as it was at the start, as full as it's been all day. While back here, in the back here, in the hell hole of hell here, fresh air has died. It's stupefied. It's smothered with sickness in here. It's suffocating, this waiting. A doctor comes and goes. A nurse comes back. A chubby young man sits side by side on a chair with a chubby young woman. She leans in her head in on his shoulder. Her face is pale, like she's not letting on that she's holding in pain. Her leg on a stand out in front of her, she nuzzles her head in onto his shoulder. Nuzzles and smiles, a nuzzle and smile, a whisper and laugh, and up he gets up and out he goes out. A quick minute later he's back, sitting down on the chair side by her side, a big bag of sweets in one hand. She leans in her head back in on his shoulder, and they open together and eat together the sweets together, dropping together the papers together onto the ground there under the chair, where together they join the other sweet papers that they've dropped together there earlier on. It's just, you know, there's different, you know, all life is there.
Does it help for you embodying different characters in the play with giving some sort of contrast to the darker themes that are there? Because obviously you do need comedic lighter moments in such a serious subject.
Oh yeah, there are. You have to have them, you know. There's a lad there who knows more about him, about medicine, than any of the doctors, you know. We get a lot of these, you know, and he starts saying things like, he has a big laugh, whoa, 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 whoa. He says, and he talks to somebody across the room, he says, Doc Martens, Talbot Street, cheaper. And it just goes on and on and on. And, you know, it's, on the one hand, it's hilarious. And, you know, another lad goes out and comes back in, having been to the chipper, and he holds up a battered sausage and he says, blessed, blessed battered sausage. You know, it's like a chip shop priest.
These are all excerpts from Headcase. It is a one-man play written by Garrett Keogh, coming to Bewley's Cafe Theatre from August 19th to September 7th. We've talked a bit about that, but Bewley's Cafe is then a fictional location in Madeira, the Secretive Sisters, which is coming to the Gap Arts Festival that you're involved with yourself, written by Michael J. Hartnett and directed by Vinnie McCabe. Two long-term friends and collaborators?
Yeah, yeah. Vinnie McCabe and I started a company called Red Rex a long, long time ago. We did a one-man show. He was Hancock in Hancock's Last Half Hour. I directed him. He directed me in a thing called The Christian Brothers. We literally put the set on the roof of a Fiat 127 and in the back in the boot with the seat down, and we toured Ireland. And after a while, we got a little bit better and bigger, and Michael Harnett had always been involved in community theatre and was successful in business, and he joined us, and we put on a number of plays, including Tom Murphy's The Blue Macushla, and then we put on Sam Shepherd's True West. Now, I had seen True West off Broadway with Gary Sinise and John Malkovich before they were big names, and it was brilliant, and I thought, you know, we should do this play. So we hired the Ablana Theatre, which you may know is in Bussaras. It's mm-hmm. down in the basement, all the terrazzo corridor down there past the toilets, and Bussaras itself is a little bit offside. So even with a cast of Anna Manahan and Manix Flynn and Barry McGovern and Vinnie himself, I directed it, the audience stayed away in droves, and it broke the bank, and it broke Red Rex. But a number of years later, a good number of years, maybe 25, 30 years later, Vinnie and Michael got together again, and they formed the Dublin Touring Theatre. And they have done a number of plays, including one called The Noble Call, which they filmed for television. And they did one called Bullied, a young girl and her grandfather experiencing two different but, you know, basically similar forms of bullying. They did The Cloud Spotter, and they have done a lot of community outreach work around Dublin. And recently they toured Germany. So their play, Madeira, with Geraldine Plunkett and Brenda Brooks and Deirdre Monaghan, is coming down to the Gap Arts Festival here in North Wexford in August 8th, 9th and 10th.
Maybe for people who aren't familiar with the Gap Arts Festival, as I wasn't, tell us a little bit about that and how it started.
I moved out of Dublin about 22 years ago. My mother, we were up, you know, all my family sold in Moore Street, and my father, I think you say that one of the first king of Dublin was a Keogh, whatever about that. My mother said, you moved out of town, she said, you're a traitor. But she liked visiting me, and it's on the side of a hill in... it's called the Wicklow Gap, the lesser known, the better known Wicklow Gap is at Glendalough. But we go from North Wexford into South Wicklow, in between Goree and Tinnehealy. There's no crossroads, there's no village, there's no theatre, but we adapt spaces in and out. When we started 14 years ago, an old man said, the last time the theatre came here, they pitched their tent in that field there, they showed a brown and white film and then did a melodrama. And, like, happily, we have followed suit because we have commissioned short films from local filmmaker Terence White. For example, we have one that we're premiering this year called Croken's Gold. And Croken is the mountain that if you're on the M11 around Arklode Goree and you look inland, you see the pointy mountain, it's Croken, Croken y Kinsella. And 1795, there was a gold rush. They found gold in a river. And the biggest nugget ever found in these islands was discovered there. It weighed something like a pound and a half. And So we've done a documentary, we've commissioned a documentary, and that'll be shown before before Madeira.
There's so many brilliant festivals like that that are set up in very unconventional locations around the country. What's it like getting audiences to come to what you do?
The thing that I find is that the people around, not just in the immediate community, but in the region, they have an appetite. They have an appetite for the arts, and they come and they love if something is on their doorstep. Not that people are incapable of going to, you know, other venues and other places. We're supported by the Arts Council and Wexford Arts Department. And over the years, I've noticed a change that festivals, they may have wanted festivals to follow a model of, you know, you start off with 1 or 2 days and then you become a weekend and a week. You do different venues, you expand. But particularly, as we were talking about, like the pandemic, and there were a lot of webinars held by the Arts Council, and there's just an amazing number of smaller bijou festivals around. And I think it's recognised that we have the Gap Arts Festival. Our motto is we bring the arts to parts that they wouldn't otherwise reach. And, you know, that's it. You know, that's there is a sense of engagement that happens that, you know, you don't get whether you go to, you know, the bigger venues or not, that it happens. And as I said, we respond to and hopefully challenge the appetite for the arts that's shown in the area.
Gara Keogh, thanks so much for coming in. Headcase, the love song of an A&E patient, comes to Bewley's Cafe Theatre August 19th to September 7th. More information available on bewleyscafetheatre.com. And Madeira, the Secrets of Sisters, is at the Gap Arts Festival with 3 dates, Thursday the 8th to Saturday the 10th of August. And details can be found on gapartsfestival.com. Set in the 18th century between London and Cork, Leanne O'Donnell's debut novel, Sparks of Bright Matter, is a magical historical account of the man credited as being the last alchemist, Peter Wolfe. Wolfe's life and fate is entwined with that of a street hustler named Suki in London and her mystical aunt Bridie, who lives in the wild west Cork hillside of Mount Gabriel. All of them are united by an infatuation with an ancient alchemical text called the Mutus Liber. Leanne O'Donnell joins me now. Leanne, welcome to Arena.
Thanks, very great to be here.
Your debut novel focuses on a very real person, Peter Wolfe. Tell me what sparked your interest in this 18th century alchemist.
It was a little bit circuitous. It kind of came from the landscape in West Cork, because I live on the foothills of Mount Gabriel. And I was aware living there that there were ancient copper mines in the mountains. So by ancient, I mean 4,000 years old. And I just got really interested in why human beings have been seeking bright things, why we have looked for precious metals, why copper, why gold. And I started to think about it in terms of, I suppose, desire. What drives people? Why do we want more than we already have? And I did a bit of research about alchemy and at some point put in Irish alchemists and came up with this real life character, Peter Wolfe.
You transposed his birthplace from Clare to Cork. Was the decision about that solely because you knew it better?
No, it wasn't because of the All-Ireland hurling final anyway.
Don't mention the war.
No, I won't mention the war. No, it was because I was really taken by the energy of the landscape where I was living. And I felt like there was a kind of universality to the story that wanted to be told. But yes, I knew that landscape better and I didn't want to have to invent a relationship with a Clare landscape. So I kind of, it came to me quite naturally to have him in West Cork and to have him on Mount Gabriel and to have that, the magic of that landscape inspiring his life, really.
Because it's always one of those questions when people take real historical figures and they then create a form of fiction around them, is where do you yourself draw the line? What are you willing to manoeuvre? What are you willing to slightly change? What are you willing to include?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I spent ages trying to get certain historical facts absolutely correct and kind of working the narrative around it, because I felt I couldn't change it. But when it came to moving him, I just didn't mind for some reason. It just felt okay. It felt right. It felt like it worked with the story. It felt like it worked with the character and it worked with the theme I was trying to explore. So I think it's kind of a very unsatisfactory answer. It was just about what felt right. It felt okay.
Everybody draws their own lines depending on where they are. Talking to authors over time, particularly those who have written historical fiction novels, research is something that authors either love or it's something they hate. It is very frequently something they get bogged down in and lost in and don't know necessarily when to drag themselves out of. Which of those was it for you?
All three. I love research and I hate research. I would say overall it's easier than writing. So the temptation is you just get lost in research because it really is easier than the creative process of putting words after words to make something that you're happy with. It's also something for me that can really spark inspiration. You know, you're kind of exploring a time period and something just kind of jumps a little bit and you think, oh, that's interesting. And it gives you a new perspective on the place and how the characters might have inhabited it. So I sort of love research and then I sort of hate it when it gets in the way of the narrative I want to tell, the story I have in my mind.
And what sort of research did you do for this one?
I did loads of reading. I mean, the tricky stuff was trying to understand alchemy. Turns out it's quite hard.
Who knew?
Who knew, yeah. I still haven't figured out how to turn lead into gold, which is somewhat disappointing. That was tricky because I needed to know a certain amount to make it make sense because, I mean, that's a line I would draw. I didn't want to have anything wrong in it. You know, it needed to be correct.
You didn't need to have 21st century alchemists saying that wouldn't have happened that way.
I did actually worry about that. I worried. It's the sort of thing that people like that might do. They might email you afterwards and say, sulfur would never do that, you know, if you put it at a high temperature. So I did get a little bit bogged down in trying to get the science right. But what I really loved, what I found really inspiring was, you know, that sort of misty, gothic London stuff. That's really fun because it feels like life is being lived in a little bit more of an extreme way. It's being lived on an edge. Everything's a little bit more dangerous. Everything's a little bit more mysterious. And I picked that time in history because it feels to me like a time where if there were ever going to be angels and demons coming down to talk to people, it would be then. In 18th century London, somewhere in an alleyway. So that was fun.
Talk to me about structure, because the story moves back and forward in time. It moves from London to Cork. Tell me a little bit about why you decided to tell it that way and not necessarily in a conventional linear form.
I found it more interesting to do it that way and maybe more authentic because, you know, the idea of a linear life or a linear narrative is a bit of a conceit, I suppose. You know, life doesn't go like that. It kind of goes back and forth and in and out and all around, or at least mine does. So I liked that aspect of it. And I think maybe what I was trying to do, sometimes it felt like an excavation. I was trying to uncover what the real story was and who the real characters were. And it just wasn't linear. It was like, well, you know, different things influenced this character and his progress through life. And they surface in different ways at different times then throughout his life. He doesn't just have one long coherent memory of his life. They just come up at different times, these memories.
I read in an interview that you did recently, you'd said that potentially your former career working not very far away from here in radio might have influenced the nature of the structure of the book.
Yeah, I think it influenced my capacity to pull a story together. I would say that. I think I learned a lot working in Doc on One, actually, about how to hold attention. I think that was quite interesting. So in the early days of making feature documentaries, I sort of had this very maybe old-fashioned idea that people would just listen because they were interested in the topic. And then I realized that actually a story has to pull you through. You have to keep somebody's attention. There's so much going on in the world. So many stories and so many books that you need to make sure, certainly in a radio feature, that people are not going off to do the dishes. They're staying with the story. So I think I learned that from the feature documentary. Stay here and listen to this story because this is an interesting story.
Because the book does that crucial thing. It has a compelling first page or first couple of pages. I don't think it's revealing anything for you to talk about the very, very opening scene of the book. But it is something that if you pick the book up in a shop, maybe not necessarily knowing anything about it, you're hooked immediately.
Oh, I hope so. Well, that's good to hear. I mean, it was interesting trying to decide where to start it. And it starts with the alchemist's apprentice. And I like that idea. So the alchemist, Peter Wolfe, is ostensibly the main character. But throughout the book, really, the very important characters are actually the people around him. So this guy, this young man, I think of him as being 16 or 17, who, when you look at him, he looks like a bit of a twit. He looks, there's a sentence in it somewhere, he's clearly dim-witted. But actually, to me, he represented a different kind of wisdom and a different kind of intelligence. But it starts out with him arriving back to his master's rooms and realizing that he's let this really crucial furnace go out and the experiment is going to be destroyed because his job was to keep it burning at a constant temperature so that the master's experiment would succeed. And he realizes as he walks in that he's let the furnace go out and all hell breaks loose.
That's far enough. Yeah, you don't reveal anymore. That's fine. You talked a little bit about it. The novel is very much steeped in the idea of place in that Dickensian London feel, and in particular, How important was it for you to ground your characters both there and I suppose in the Cork setting as well?
Really important. I mean, I think I'm sort of fascinated by how we're influenced and how we might be in relationship with place. And by that, I mean landscape in terms of the West Cork segments. For me, there was almost a sense that there was a potential dialogue going on between some of the characters and the landscape and the history of the landscape. And then similarly in London, it's a very extraordinary place to try and imagine this city that has emerged out of a big town and that has become this metropolis and has become one of the major cities of the world in the 18th century, where some of the most amazing inventions are going to be found within the next 50 years from where my story is set. So it's this vibrating, exciting place, but it's also full of poverty and full of exploitation. So yeah, grounding them in place was really important to me.
The book, the Mutus Liber, which I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, which is the centre of the novel, it's a real book. It really actually existed. And yeah, it's one of those kind of crossover points between literature and some form of magic, or at least it would like to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. You were asking me about the research earlier, and I was writing a scene where the young Peter Wolfe, so we meet him first when he's an older alchemist, but in my head, I suddenly saw him at 17, walking through London, his first summer in London, and I realised he was carrying a book. And the sentence came to me, he's walking through the streets of London and he's carrying a book. Now, it was a better sentence than that when I finished with it. But what became interesting, I was like, oh, well, what book is he carrying? I didn't know what book he was carrying. So I had to do a little bit of kind of looking around and reading to think, what kind of book would a guy like that be carrying? And he's carrying it because he's been told to bring it to somebody. And I knew that much. And then I discovered the Mutus Liber and realised it was the perfect sort of cipher for everything I was trying to explore, because it's a book without text. It's a book with images. And the idea is that if you can decode the images, you'll be able to make the Philosopher's Stone. And it's a real life book. Carl Jung had a copy of it and he pored over it. But nobody knew who wrote it, so it's quite mysterious.
The book has incredibly strong female characters and there isn't a whiff of cliche off any of them. You manage that really well. It's obviously important.
Well, that makes me really happy that you say that. For me, it was interesting because of the time frame that they were living in, because women were ostensibly disempowered. And these two women are poor. They have no material resources and neither of them have husbands, which are the two ways to have any kind of power as a woman during that period. So I think what I was trying to explore is, how do these women still have power and still have dignity in systems that have no room for them really to have either? So I got really engrossed and interested in the way that they would go through this difficult world that they were in while retaining their selfhood and their potency. So that's why maybe they feel real, because I really imagined myself into it.
I want you to tell me a little bit about the Irish myths that you explore through Bridie Leary. Mainly, you might be able to do that by telling me a little bit about the podcast that you're involved in as well, because that might assist both.
Yeah, well, the podcast is called Into the Mythic, and it's this lovely project that I really enjoy doing with my friend Paul O'Colman, who runs the Working Artist Studios in Ballydehob in County Cork. And together, he knows a lot of the stories, and I kind of vaguely do, but he tells me the stories and we talk about them in this way, which is about trying to make them still alive. Like, what is the resonance for us now? Where is the living heart of these stories? But actually, that all happened after I wrote that section in the book. And the section in the book is later on in the book, we discovered that the old woman who lives on Peter's farm is actually the person who remembers this kind of ancient story about settlement on the mountain. And you call it a myth, but I made it up, basically.
Isn't that what all great myths are?
Yeah, I know, maybe. And it was quite ambitious to make up a myth. It sort of came to me one night as a sort of foundation myth for the people of the mountain, that this is what had happened. So I wove it into a story that she tells the young Peter. So that's where that came from.
You've alluded to, on the off chance that people have had the chance to read the entire book, that you might end up reusing some of these characters later on at some other stage. Is that, do you want to just put them to one side for a minute and move on to something else? Or is that still something that's working around in the back of your head?
Yeah, it's working around in the back of my head. I definitely want to do something else first. That was a very intense book to write. It was kind of quite an ambitious first novel to get embedded in. And I think I can't do that straight away now again. But I would be quite interested in figuring out what happens, or seeing what happens to Mal, the boy that starts the book. He's the apprentice who seems very dim, but he has quite an interesting journey that I don't want to give up. I don't want to give away too much about what happens to him. Mm-hmm. But there's more, I think, to investigate about what happens to him.
So what does happen next right now for you?
For me, I'm going to go meet my friends and have a drink. And then I'm going to go home and I'm writing the next book. I'm in the next book.
I've heard that having a drink is a good experience after being interviewed on Arena. I think it's the only way to go.
I think so too.
Leanne O'Donnell, my thanks to you. Leanne's latest novel, Sparks of Bright Matter, is published by Eriu, and Leanne will be at the Skibbereen Arts Festival next week at an event called Angels and Alchemy with Cara Bell.
RTE Radio 1. Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. The Wild God Tour. Into my arms. An extra date added. 3 Arena, November 13th. Tickets available now. Presented by Aiken Promotions. Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
Check out Super Value's Real Rewards prices. Scan your card or app and get Meridian Smooth or Crunchy Peanut Butter 1kg was €10.99, now €5. And Fairy Platinum Plus dishwasher tablets 48-piece, now €10. Plus, save even more with weekly vouchers on the Real Rewards app. Make real savings every week at Super Value.
Flogas, as the official energy partner of Team Ireland, believe it takes the right type of energy to inspire Olympians like Ciara McGeehan.
When I'm running, I think of the people back home in Portaferry who believed in me years before there were ever any medals in the picture. On the good days and the bad days, that's what gives me the energy to push on.
That's why Flogas are proud to be the energy behind Team Ireland on the road to Paris 2024. Flogas, energy for everyone.
Morning fresh espresso under cypress trees. Cruise glistening seas around the island of Capri. Family fun in the Sicilian seaside sun. Pizza making on a piazza by ultra chic boutiques. Sighing at the bridges of Venice. Lake Garda. The Dolce Vita savoring a Sorrento gelato. Pompeii. The perched pastel houses of Positano. Like floating lights. And of course, Rome. There are many sides to Italy. We'll help you discover them. Top Flight. Book your Italian holiday at topflight.ie.
Once upon a time, there was a charity that made books written by children for children. They sent their books all over Ireland, and they saved up to €45 on every pack of stamps they bought. But it wasn't magic. It was their OnPost Commerce Advantage card. It gives charities like Kids Own Publishing Partnership great discounts on their sending. Get your Advantage card at onpost.com/advantage card to save on every stamp you stick and every parcel you send. OnPost Commerce, a world closer. T's and C's apply.
A woman in Mountjoy Prison reflects on the terrible events that landed her there, and a middle-aged man meets a younger rent boy in a dingy B&B. In trade, Mary Motorhead, Irish National Opera, has adapted a pair of operas from two renowned Mark O'Halloran plays. The works were adapted for opera theatre by Mark O'Halloran's niece Emma, who composed the libretto and the score. The duo of one-act operas played to acclaim in New York and LA last year, but now it's coming home to Ireland, where it will debut at the Kilkenny Arts Festival next month before shows as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival in October, and then a small tour to Tralee, Ennis and Navan. I'm delighted to be joined by the conductor Elaine Kelly and mezzo-soprano Naomi Louisa O'Connell, who plays the title role of Mary Motorhead. Elaine, if I could start with you, how did this project come about? These are based on existing Mark O'Halloran works, but it is a reinterpretation and it's done by his own niece, which is unusual in and of itself.
Yeah, they're incredible. They've already composed. Emma's already composed a piece on Mark O'Halloran's text, and we first performed this back in 2020 with Irish National Opera as part of 20 Shots of Opera. And actually, this was with Naomi as well, who sang it, and it was an incredible piece. I mean, the text, as we all know, Mark O'Halloran is really quite extraordinary, and the text that he writes is amazing, and Emma equally incredibly set this text to music, and I immediately fell in love with her music. It's extraordinary and it's real and it's honest. And so we first worked together on that, and then Irish National Opera, in with Beth Morrison Productions, they co-commissioned this piece with Emma O'Halloran, who then set two of Mark O'Halloran's plays to operas.
Naomi Louisa, tell me about Mary Motorhead first and how you got involved with it.
Oh, she's a hell of a character. She's just very violent, very much fun to play. Emma got in touch with me on Instagram, actually. That's how we met. She came into my messages and she said, "Hey, I think I'm writing a piece for you." And she sent me Mark's play and I had a read of it. And it is a remarkable, gritty character based on a real person, I think, that he met at one stage in Ennis.
We might swap you to a different microphone because apparently I've been told that people can't hear what you're saying. We might ask you to scooch up a little.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
This is live radio, folks.
yeah, no worries.
And tell me a little more about that then.
Okay, well, like I was telling you there, Emma got in touch with me on Instagram and she said, "I think I'm writing a piece for you." And the Mary Motorhead piece came about actually through a competition Emma was entering, which was run by Beth Morrison Projects. And she set this 30-minute piece of Mark's to music. And suddenly this character, which fills a room, it's remarkable actually how powerful she is. And Emma's music has a kind of clarity. There is something about her. I was saying this to Elaine the other day, that you always know when it's her. She has a very distinct musical voice, which is unusual, I think, in a young composer. A lot of the time you have to write a few pieces and you find yourself, you find your sound. With Emma, you hear it and you know it's her immediately. I find that remarkable.
Was it strange or unusual at any point? Was there a conversation had about her adapting Mark's work for this, because it's when it's somebody who's a member of your own family, that's an unusual one?
Well, she said that she just loved the play. She saw it in Bewley's Theatre and it stuck with her. I mean, that's years ago now that she first saw it, and she was looking for something to set and this just, you know, fell into her lap. Why wouldn't you, you know?
Naomi Louisa, it's opera theatre. Maybe explain to those people who aren't necessarily familiar with the term what that means, and then maybe what it means for you as a performer.
Good question. Well, opera, we were talking about this right before coming in, is a container word in itself. And I think when we say opera theatre, it makes it a little bit more clear that this is about character building. It's about relationships between people. And when we think of opera sometimes, certainly when I first heard the word opera, I thought of it as women dying dramatically with very, you know, lots of high notes. And I mean, I love opera like that too, I have to say. But this is something that is grittier. It's a little bit more on the cusp of realism. Yeah. And it's so much fun to play. It feels very big in the room. Very immediate. I think people will be surprised that it falls under the label of opera, but it is actually the perfect version of it. For me, you know, I love that kind of thing.
We're going to play a clip from Mary Motorhead. It is you performing. Maybe you could set that up for us a little bit if you can.
You have the beginning of the piece, is it?
We do, as far as I know.
Great. So Mary, this is when you first meet her. She's in the cell. We set up in the piece that she is talking directly to the audience. A monodrama can be heavyweight, you know, you're just the one person there and the audience. And they buy into the fact that they are in the cell with her, listening. And she's talking about big history and little history and her understanding of her own past, trying to make sense of it for herself.
Okay, let's play that clip now.
The present in a way. there are two types of history. The first I call big history. The men, the big events, the scores and the kings.
That's absolutely fantastic. Elaine, then tell us a story about trade. It was, people might be familiar with it from seeing the film Rialto that Tom Vaughan Lawler starred in a couple of years ago. It's about a middle-aged man and a rent boy who meet.
Yeah. So trade is based in Dublin's north inner city, and we're in a guest house, and these two men are meeting to have sex. And the older man is in his 50s. He's married to his wife and his children. And the younger guy, he is 18, he has a girlfriend and also has a child. And they've met a number of times before, and this opera is just their latest encounter and what comes from that.
What's it like to bring these works home, having had them performed elsewhere?
It's quite incredible. We were so excited to go to New York and LA last year and to perform these pieces there. And we couldn't have been more delighted with the reviews and the responses that we got from them. But there's something incredibly exciting about bringing them home. I mean, these are Irish pieces. You've got an Irish playwright, an Irish composer, Irish performers. And more so, these pieces are Irish. They are Irish, and they're very much set in our culture and in our thinking. And in the way we speak, Emma has an incredible talent at setting text. Mm-hmm. It's outstanding, and it's very natural. And it's very much nearly, especially in trade, I think, where the text is set the exact way that you would speak to somebody, with just a little bit of voice pushed underneath it. And so it's very conversation-like, it's very realistic, it's very natural. And so I think it has more of an impact, and you can really connect to what they are saying. And so, I mean, we were talking the other day actually about Mary Motorhead, that, you know, the word Mountjoy Prison, you know, we always got a laugh about that in the States, but here we don't even think about Mountjoy, the name of that for prison. Mm. And so, you know, that it will land differently with Irish audiences. And then with trade, I mean, we talk about Fairview Park and Ballybock, and we're bringing up all these places. But it's also, I think it's the culture we have as Irish people and the thinking that we have. And these men are talking about things that are very difficult to talk about, or that people don't talk about. And it's, and the opera's kind of pushing past that, and them nearly having no choice, but it has to come out in some way, but then jumping in with some kind of self-deprecating remark because they realise that they've gone to a point where, oh my gosh, I can't believe I've said that. I need to try and make a laugh out of this. Mm. So it's very Irish. And so that's why it's very exciting to bring it home and to give it to Irish people and see their reaction, and hopefully that they'll connect with it.
Okay, I want to play a clip from Trade, and we'll come back to you just after this.
Had a car he had, and he asked, so I went with him. That was he gave me money after. I was laughing. I didn't care. I didn't give a fuck. I was 14. It was easy.
I mean, mean, there's obviously huge social realism there, Elaine. How does that marry with opera as a form?
Well, I suppose it's again, it's this text that, like, I mean, opera can have a connotation about it, and that it's, as Naomi was saying earlier, it's, you know, the lady in the centre, she's dying, and she's, you know, the it's the tragic story of everything. But I think opera can be so much more than that, and it can connect with everybody in some level. And especially, I think that contemporary opera can also have a connotation to it. But these operas are these opera theatre pieces are so real. And it's really bringing these theatre pieces to life with music, which gives it a bit of a boost in terms of the emotion that's there.
You were involved in this work from an early stage onward. What is it like being in there from the very ground up on a very contemporary piece like this?
It's fantastic. I mean, working on contemporary pieces, I love, because you don't have that historical background that you have with working on traditional repertoire. You don't have records that you can listen to, or forms that you can go to, someone to speak to. Everyone gets the score, that same score, and it's your understanding of it on this very basic level, and it's coming together and exploring this score together. And what's so lovely is this is our third time coming back to this piece, Naomi and I anyway. And it's constantly finding new ways with Mary, and we're still finding new avenues or new thoughts that she's having, and exploring that. And it's lots of fun to do.
I know your voice has almost left you for the evening, Naomi Louisa, but you're obviously looking forward to this hugely.
Absolutely. Yeah, I cannot wait to get it on stage in Kilkenny, really. Yeah.
It has been brilliant talking to both of you this evening, Elaine Kelly and Naomi Louise O'Connell. Thank you so much for joining me this evening. If you liked what you heard there, Trade Mary Motorhead will be at the Kilkenny Arts Festival next month from August 8th to 11th. For more information, you can check out kilkennyarts.ie and get tickets there as well. The operas will then be at the Pavilion in Dunleary from Friday the 11th of October for 3 nights as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. And then the show will be in Cork, Tralee, Ennis and Navan. For more details on dates and tickets of those, you can visit irishnationalopera.ie, and that's where you'll find all the details for that. Earlier on, we played you a clip from Sean Kane's Isle of Hope, Isle of Tears, and asked which of his siblings did he record that track with for the album A Winter's Tale. It was his sister Dolores Kane, of course. Aisling Caulfield in Ballyhaunis, a win for Mayo. Congratulations. Texted the correct answer, and we'll be going to see Sean Kane with the RTE Concert Orchestra at the National Concert Hall on the 30th of August. That is it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Barbara Rose Sanwo. Niall McMonagle was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced, of course, by Reg Luby. Thank you, Reg. Aideen Gormley will be here with you tomorrow night. I'm Rick O'Shea. I'll catch you on RTE Gold for the rest of the week at 1 o'clock in the afternoon if you're knocking around. John Creedon is up next after the news at 8 o'clock.